Well, it's my brother Ruby. I'm Henry Whitfield. I run the PTSD counselling project here for victim support. Also, PIR UK, where we've done lots of training counsellors in new counselling techniques, mainly what we're best known for trauma. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome Marianne Volkman.
Thank you. It gives me great pleasure to be here. I was invited to speak to you, and I was allowed to choose my own topic, which was really great. So I chose happiness, and then I thought, oh, does that sound frivolous and silly? Will anybody want to hear about that? But the more I thought about it, the more I thought that actually happiness has to do with survival and life itself. That's what I think. We'll see what you think by the end of this, okay? I hope not to make this a big infomercial, but to some extent I can't help it. I want to call your attention to this excellent book put together by my spouse, Beyond Trauma, Conversations on Traumatic Incident Reduction. If you're unfamiliar with the subject, this is a really good place to start. And anybody who's involved in victim services type stuff, I'd like to talk to you after just for a few minutes, because there's a new book coming out that might be even more to your interest, although there's a chapter specifically on that in this book, okay? And then there's my book, Life Skills, and this is kind of an overview of the bigger subject that TIR, Traumatic Incident Reduction, comes from, called Applied Metapsychology. This is just for anybody to use in their own life, or for counselors and therapists to use with their clients, so it's sort of a multi-purpose book. There's quite a number of factors in the subject of metapsychology that have a strong impact on the subject of happiness, and each one of those I could talk about for a long time. So it's a challenge to kind of tone it down into a workable length of talk. So first let's start with, how would you define happiness? Who wants to venture a definition of happiness?
Personal gratification.
Okay. Personal gratification. Good. Anybody else?
Have a positive outlook on life, any events that happen in your life.
Good. Anybody else?
Self-actualization is important.
Yeah, self-actualization. Very good. Are you satisfied with that? Should we keep working on it, or are you happy with that? All right, we'll keep going, and then we'll see by the end if you want to change it at all. Anybody have any theories about what causes happiness? What brings about happiness? Obviously, self-actualization would be one of those things. What else?
Problems.
Problems cause happiness?
Yes.
Very good. Yes, I would agree with you, and we'll get into that in a minute. Anybody disagree with her that problems cause happiness? It's okay, you can admit it if you disagree. I'm taking
it. Isn't it from the resolution of problems that leads to happiness?
Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. We'll just put that one on hold for a minute.
I think it depends on the problem, maybe, and where you are.
Well, that's true, too. That's true, too.
And whether the problems get resolved.
Yeah.
And whether they're the right problems.
Yeah. Good. Anybody else?
Any gain in harmony
tends to make a great happy. Harmony?
Any gain in harmony.
Yeah. Very good.
I wanted to say something similar to feeling unity, you say?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Feeling your life is moving in the direction you want it to go.
Yeah. Good. So all of those things, right? All of those things would have bearing. Good. I just thought we'd start there with some kind of definition before we plunge downward. Oh, and I was supposed to introduce myself, and I didn't really do that. I'm somebody who's been involved with traumatic incident reduction since his earliest days. I was lucky to meet Dr. Frank Urbode, affectionately known to one and all as Sarge, through mutual friends before he wrote his book, actually, and we've been fast friends ever since. When I finally met him and the people he was kind of gathering around him, I felt like, ah, finally, my spiritual home, this is where I belong. So it was very delightful to meet up with that group of people. And I'm certainly not limited to TIR and metapsychology in my practice, but it's the best set of tools I've found so far, for the most part, for getting the job done. So, that's enough about me. We can talk about it. If you have any questions, I'll answer them afterwards. How does that sound? Okay, so I would make the challenging statement here that you actually don't want to be happy. That you'd be miserable if you were happy. That you would be bored to tears if you were happy. In the sense that you don't want to win all the time, do you, really? No. And that fits along with what Kate said, that actually problems do, to some degree, make us happy. The proof of that is, how many people in here have ever played a video game?
Okay, or some other kind of game. Anybody ever here not played any kind of game? Okay. Okay, so what's the first thing you want to do when you get to the point where you can win that game all the time? Yeah, make it harder. Move to the next level. So if it was just about winning, we'd stay there and keep on winning the game and say, oh, see, great, I'm happy. No, we're bored. We want a challenge, right? So really what we want is challenge, we want drama, we want effort, and we want risks. Without that, life is pretty tame stuff, right? Now, people vary hugely in what they find challenging and what they find risky and what they find gives them drama and effort and excitement, right? Some people jump out of airplanes. Some people, you know, go to disasters and help people who have just been in a horrendous disaster. Some people are, you know, work in emergency rooms, you know, with people coming in bleeding all over the place. In fact, my flight over here, I was sitting next to a doctor, and that's what he does. He works in an emergency department, and he loves his job. He's just thrilled to pieces. I mean, he's not happy that people are hurt, but it's so exciting to him to manage. He was like managing the whole thing and, you know, meeting the need of all these people in huge crisis, and that really turns him on. So, you know, that's good. And then, you know, there's some people who just putter around in their garden and they're perfectly happy, apparently, you know, watching TV or something like that. Hard for me to relate to, but there's a lot of variety, wouldn't you agree? Okay. So, and actually, I wouldn't knock it. If somebody's puttering around in their garden and they're not doing any harm and they're pretty cheerful and they're having a positive effect on the people around them, I say, hey, more power to them. They're not out there changing the world, but they're at least not having a negative effect, right? Okay. And one thing I've seen in my work, as I work with people doing resolving traumas and also moving into the area of personal growth, is that as people resolve the past and things from the past they're dragging around with them like a sack of cannonballs, they start getting rid of the cannonballs one by one, and then they start to sort of blossom and take on bigger spheres of responsibility, different, you know, wider spheres of influence, which will give them more challenge and risk and everything else, right? Okay, so making a difference, I would also propose to you, is a big component of happiness. And whether that's making a difference because you make a beautiful little garden and you're happy with that, or whether you're out there on the front lines of whatever, facing up to difficult things and making a difference in individual people's lives or on a, you know, social or global level, that's really what gives life some juice. And I know, talking to this bunch of people, I'm preaching to the choir, you've already had that realization or you would not be in the fields that you're in, right? There's nothing really that matches up to it, is there? Really making a difference for somebody, really, really helping them resolve something so that they can have new hope and go on, it's a thrill, right? I've been doing it for years and years and years, and I never, ever get tired of it. I love to do it, I love to teach it, and I love to write about it. So, I'm pretty sold on this stuff. So, I have to get my glasses on, I can't read my notes. So I would also propose to you that it's not just succeeding at our goals that gives us happiness, but it's the actual doing of the actual practice of whatever we're doing, the doing of it. And if that isn't true, we aren't going to really be happy. A friend of mine once said that she observed that if somebody said, oh, what I really want to do is be an oil painter, that's what I want to do, I want to paint in oil. If they were going to make it, they enjoy every little bit of doing that. They even enjoy cleaning their brushes. And then they're going to be happy. They're going to be successful and they're going to be happy if they enjoy every part of it. I mean, there are certain parts that probably, if you have to do lots of paperwork and stuff like that, that might not be your most fun part. But the actual practice of what you do, if that is enjoyable to you, that is, like, to me, almost the pinnacle of, at least in the terms of work, if you have work that you love, that you can sink your teeth into and it asks of you your best and asks of the other people you work with their best, it's really dynamite stuff, right? Okay. All right. So now, might seem silly, but I want to use this as an analogy, and I want to see if you can entertain this possibility, okay? Let's just look at life as a game, okay? If you look at it as a game, like a giant Monopoly game, you know, you have your marker and you move it around the board, only it's more complicated than Monopoly because you have to buy clothing for it to wear and cars and bus tickets and train tickets for you to ride around in, and you have to feed it, and you know, it's much more complicated than Monopoly. But if we look at it as a giant game, the purpose of doing that is it gives us a little more space and distance to look at it, okay? So the thing about the game of life is that win or lose, we're going to die in the end anyway, right? That's just true. So then it's sort of like, well, what constitutes success, right? What constitutes the things that would make us happy in life, and so we could, and when we die, we say, wow, great life, you know, that was terrific. Which is, that's where I want to be when I die, whenever that happens to be. Hopefully not for a while, I've got lots of things I want to do. But it gives us some space to observe what we're doing and to evaluate what we're doing, and I think it's very useful. So I'll give you an example. There was a time in my life when things were going not well. My relationship with my husband was not going well. My relationship with my daughter was not going well. And my career was not going well. So altogether, I was pretty depressed. It was actually horrible. Hi. Okay. So, it was interesting. I was driving down the road, and it was September, about this time of year, and in Michigan it's colder now in September than it is here. And the leaves were just starting to turn. I don't know if you know this, but in Michigan and in Ontario, the leaves are absolutely magnificent when they turn. So they were just starting to turn, so it's a beautiful gold and yellow and red and orange in the trees. I was driving down the road feeling like, life sucks, you know, in that kind of mood that one gets into sometimes. And all of a sudden, I was sitting at a stoplight, and I was looking at a beautiful tree, and I thought, I won't always be here. And instantly, everything changed. Because I realized, okay, this game of life is not infinite. It's not like trudging along through, even if you're in a kind of a low point, realizing that there's really an end there. Somehow I got more engaged in my life in that moment. I said, oh, okay, yikes, I won't always be here. I better be here while I'm being here, because I might miss it otherwise, and I'll come to the end and say, oh, I wasn't paying attention. That would be terrible, right? So I actually felt happier in that moment. Isn't that a strange thing? Of realizing that I wasn't always going to be here. Making it a game, considering it a game, makes it actually more interesting. And also, it's the limitations that make it a game and make it interesting. If you look at a game like football, soccer, whatever you want to call it, people kicking objects around the field, there's lines on the field, right, to say, this is the playing field, and outside of that is out of bounds. And then we say, oh, this is the goal for one team, and that's the goal for the other team, and the whole game is getting this object into the other person, into the goal that gives us points. When you think about it, completely absurd. Why would we do this? But just because it's a game, only that, right? But we invest ourselves in things in order to have something that really interests us. We invest ourselves in those things, right? And there's quite a few factors that really affect happiness and that we can use to increase our happiness. So some of these are part of the basics of the subject of applied metapsychology, and I want to run a few of them by you. And again, this is like we're just touching on it, and there's a lot more to be said, but I just wanted to give you an overview. Also, I'll give you a little advance infomercial. It took me years and years to write this book. I finally got it done, and now I'm working on two more. One is called True Love, which I've been working on for years and years and years, and the other one's called Perfect Happiness, because I thought there are certain keys to happiness, and I believe that human beings are capable of being way happier than they think they can a lot of the time. That's what I think. Anybody violently disagree with that? A little bit disagree with that? Okay, well, anyway. In this book, you can see I talk about human potential. That's what I'm really interested in. What is human potential, and how do we get there? How good can it get, and how do we How do we get there? How do we maintain it? How do we keep expanding our boundaries? All right. So, perfect. Some of my ideas, some of these ideas are coming from the Perfect Happiness book, which does not yet exist. Okay, so Dr. Gerbode came up with this model for understanding relationships that I just want to put on here quickly. So, the components, better not write and talk at the same time. Okay. That's communication, even though it doesn't look so good. Comprehension. And affection. He determined these were the three components to what he called communion. And he means it not in the religious sense, obviously, but in the sense of connection between people. You know, connection and interchange between people. So when we have communication and we have comprehension or understanding and we have affection, we have communion. And it could be at a very light social level. Like, you know, you say hi to the person, you buy a morning paper for them every morning, and they say hi to you. There's a certain amount of, you know, a little bit of communion there, even though it's not deep. And then there's the people you know pretty well that you have a lot more of this with. And then there's the people who are your intimates, who are your closest family and friends, and hopefully, have lots of communion with those people because you have lots of shared memories and common goals and things like that. So understanding this is really a key to happiness, because if you understand how it works, you can do things deliberately to increase the amount of communion in your life, okay? So usually we enter into it through communication. We meet somebody, we don't know them, so we start talking to them to find out kind of who they are and what are they about, right? As we do that, we develop some comprehension. We find out, we have some common ground. We're interested in some of the same things. We understand this person more because they're intelligently interested in the same things we're interested in. And then we start to feel some affection for that person, and it all goes up together. The more you like them, the more you feel like communicating with them, the more you feel like you understand them, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes we enter into it through comprehension. I like to use my husband as an example. He's been used as an example all over the world. He probably doesn't quite realize this, but he used to be a very shy person. You would not believe this to meet him now, but he used to be terribly shy. And he liked to go to science fiction conventions. Anybody here been to a science fiction convention? They're really wild. Okay, so it's very easy to have two main groups, and you would not have any trouble distinguishing one from the other. One group is the hard science guys, and the other group is the fantasy people. And the fantasy people wear very strange clothing, and sometimes it's very scanty, and they wear sparkly things on themselves, and things you can always tell. And, hard science guys look a little more nerdy, right? So my shy husband could go to a science fiction convention, and he could easily spot the hard science guys. And he could, you know, they could be sitting in a lecture about new discoveries in astronomy, and they could have a stripe of a conversation quite easily because the comprehension's already there. It's not like having to break the ice and communicate with a person you know nothing about and try and establish something. It's already something's established, so it's a little easier to start talking to that person. Same thing as if you go to a conference or a convention or something on a subject you're really interested in, you sort of assume there's some common ground, and it's just easier to strike up a conversation, right? Okay, and sometimes you meet somebody and you just really like them, and you don't even know them yet. You don't know why you like them, you just like them, but then you feel like communicating to find out what they're about, and then you like them and you understand them, and you know, it all goes up together. Now the thing to know about this is, when it breaks, like it all goes up together, but when it breaks, it all comes down together. Okay? When one of these things breaks, it's like sticking a pin in a balloon. Alright? So, let's say your friend says, let's get together, I'll meet you at 2 o'clock, and I'll meet you under the clock. So, there you are at 2 o'clock, you're under the clock, you're waiting, and 5 minutes goes by, 10 minutes goes by, sometime it was traffic. You know, maybe 15 minutes and maybe you're still okay, and then 17 minutes after you think, you get mad, right? The affection just completely drops out. There's no comprehension, no what's going on, and there's no communication. So, now that happens actually less often now that we have cell phones, doesn't it? But it used to happen all the time. But that's just kind of a trivial example, but that's how it works. The whole thing comes down. If they show up finally at 25 minutes after, because assuming you waited that long, you might find out maybe they had a flat tire. And then you say, oh, well, 25 minutes is pretty good for a flat tire, and you understand what's happening. The communication goes back in, the comprehension goes back up, the affection goes back up, and it's all fine. Okay, so it's important to know this, because the bigger amount of communion, the bigger the break if it breaks. Okay? So using my balloon analogy, if you have a balloon that's kind of wrinkled and old and there's not much air left in it, if you stick a pin in it, not much happens, right? It's just kind of, that's it. If you have one that's kind of somewhat blown up, so it's a little bit tight, you stick a pin in it, it makes a pop, right? If it's really blown up to the tightest it can possibly be, and you stick a pin in it, it goes bang. So the thing is that the more affection, comprehension, communication you have with somebody, the more communion you have with them, the bigger the upset when it breaks. Yes.
So does that mean it's an indication of the health of a relationship, that if you fight, it's really volatile and noisy, and if you don't care about them anymore, in fact, don't fight?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. So then there's all kinds of things that you can do to repair breaks. One is just to be, you can use this model as a way to repair breaks. I taught some roommates I had once, I taught them this, and I was in the kitchen one day, and they came into the living room. One said to the other one, do we have an upset? The other one said, yes, I think we do. And the first one said, well, let's figure it out. And the other one said, okay. And they sat on the couch and they said, okay, let's see, is our break in communication, comprehension, affection, or communion? Ah, I think it was a break in comprehension. When you said this, blah, blah, blah. And the other one said, oh, well, for me, it was a break in communication because you didn't tell me, and blah, blah, blah. And the other one, oh, they're using it. So just, you can use that model as a way of taking it apart. It's just a way of understanding it. Okay? So, I'm not going to get into a big thing on that. I just want to say that we have the opportunity to increase communion all around us every day. We really, really do. And the simplest way is just recognizing other living people. Just seeing them, recognizing them. Everybody wants this. Everyone wants this recognition and acknowledgement. All too rarely do we get it. And so if you take this on as a practice, as an exercise, it's the simplest way to raise communion in your environment. It's a very generous gift to give somebody else. And that's either somebody you're buying a newspaper from, or you have any little interaction with, or a stranger on the street. Lots of them won't look at you, but if they look at you, you can say good morning. You know, it doesn't really cost anything. And I find that people in England are more likely to say good morning than people in the United States. Isn't that interesting? Whatever.
I love to put it together.
Yeah, but it's not. You guys are more friendly than we are in some ways, I think. So, you know, if you can do that, you know, instant connection and just, you know, I see you there, a little friendly connection, you brighten their day and you brighten your own day at the same time. And then if there's somebody that you interact with on a regular basis, you know, you've got more scope because you can get a little bit of a conversation going. And then, if there's somebody who is near and dear to you, they're the hardest, really. It's more of a challenge because we have more reasons to take them to task, tell them what they did wrong, things like that. But it's something to be aware of. And you know, if you want to improve the quality of your relationships, you can just actually look at what increases the communion and what takes it down. And the more communion you have, the happier you are. In fact, I've heard it called the reward for living. Because living is really pretty fraught sometimes, isn't it? There's pain, difficulty, taxes, traffic, all kinds of things. But it's communion that makes it all worthwhile, I think most people think. All right, so I could go on and on and on about that, but I'm going to leave it at that. Any parts of this, at the end, if there's any parts you want to kind of come back to, we can revisit that. Okay, so, but moving right along. How many people here have heard of the emotional scale? Some, not all, of course. Okay, so this is a little tiny
version of the emotional scale right here, and it's actually a chart of attitudes of all different areas of life plotted against this emotional scale. It's really quite interesting. So there's, you know, you could write whole books about this subject. There's a lot to know about it, but we're going to look at it in terms of happiness. So at the top is, I'm going to just say elation. I mean, you could say bliss above that. There we have bliss above that. Enthusiasm. And then we have cheerfulness. Two E's would be good. Conservatism. Conservatism, it doesn't mean like in the political sense necessarily. It just sort of means like sort of means like don't rock the boat. Let's keep things the same. Everything's okay. Let's not change anything. Thank you, Astrid. Complacency, which is thinking everything is fine the way it is. Sorry. Complacency. Crappy job I'm doing here. Ambivalence. Ambivalence is when you could sort of take it or leave it, you know, either way. You're kind of waiting for something to come along and entertain you. Right? Antagonism. That's when things start to get more interesting here. Antagonism, anger. And there's lots of other things we could put in here. This is resentment. Mm-hmm. This is just hitting the high points. Hidden hostility, that's always a good one. You know, the person who, they always smile at you, and then you feel like you've always got a knife stuck in your back when you walk away after talking to them. Yeah, that's hidden hostility. Anxiety, very prevalent. Fear. Grief. And apathy. That's called grief, right? Yeah. Apathy. Okay, so this is the basic emotional scale. Very, very interesting. We could study this forever because I was trained on this and then I, you know, learned to observe my clients moving up and down on this. Sometimes they come in and they're kind of in some kind of a complacent, ambivalent place when they actually come in for a session. Then if I'm going to ask them to go into a trauma, they might go way down here. They might even go to apathy. They're like lying on the table, you know, hardly moving. And grief, they cry, and they're afraid, and they're angry. And they usually come up to at least conservatism, if not cheerfulness or enthusiasm, by the end of the session. That's one of the things that TIRs really got going for it, is getting those endpoints that are very satisfying to the client. Okay. So another thing we could look at in terms of this is vibration. Not to get all woo-woo on you, but, and how many people have ever read the little book called The Lazy Man's Guide to Enlightenment? I highly recommend it. It's actually on the internet now. It was out of print for a long, long time. And the guy died who wrote it, so now somebody's republished it, but in the meantime, you couldn't buy one except for like $83 on eBay or something, so somebody typed it all in and it's on the internet floating around for free. Very, very interesting little book. And he talks about vibration, and his idea is that it's all about raising our vibration. So, you know, when you're really down in the pit, how it feels kind of slow and heavy and like that. And when you're feeling way up, it's kind of like you're vibrating at a light, high, fine level. So it's just a way to think about it. I'm not telling you it is that way, although I suppose we could invent some kind of way of measuring it. I bet we could, you know. But it's just a way to think about it, and if it's useful to you, use it. Otherwise, you can throw it out the window. So, again, you can use this as a tool, and you can say, okay, what kinds of things tend to help me rise up on the emotional scale as opposed to sinking down into the pit? And I know there's times when we want to get in there and confront and face up to horrible, painful things. Like when we do trauma work or grief work, we're deliberately going in there and facing that, aren't we? And there's a value to that, because if we don't face it, we're dragging it around like a cannonball behind us for the whole rest of our life. So there's certainly a time for everything. But, generally speaking, it's a whole lot more fun to be higher rather than lower.
Okay? So the ideal is not that you be stuck in elation all the time. There's no such thing as stuck at the top. Actually, the ideal human condition is when you can kind of move around up and down as it's appropriate. Okay? With me so far on this? Okay, good. So one thing I really want to get across is that once a person does their work and they clean out the past, so the past stuff is not bothering them anymore, then they can experience any one of these emotions and not have it be horribly, horribly painful. I remember earlier in my life when something bad happened, if I had a loss, I would feel bad about that loss, and I would also think of every other loss I had that was remotely similar. I'd drag them all out and I'd mull over them until I felt really terrible. I don't know why, but there's just, we sort of tend to do that, don't we? We go, oh yeah, this reminds me of the time, blah blah. You know, and we just feel bad about all these things at once, and it's really hard. Okay, when my mother died, which is a, you know, obviously a big loss, no question about it. By that time, I'd done lots and lots of work clearing out the past, so I felt the grief of her loss as a pure, clean grief, unmuddied up with all kinds of other stuff. And it was actually not that horrible. I mean, not something you choose, like, oh boy, I guess I'll get up and feel grief today. But, you know, it happens. Stuff happens in life. We're constantly involved in, you know, ups and downs, and we're trying to do things, and we win and lose, and You know, before we die, a lot of the people we know are going to die. So, you know, it's just stuff we have to deal with. If you can feel the emotion nice and clean and pure as itself, it's not that horrible. Same thing with anger. Anger tends to be muddied up with all kinds of other junk. But if you're feeling anger just in the moment and you can be really focused on what it is you're angry about, you can actually use that energy to do something positive. Instead of, you know, wander around in it, wallowing around in it. Does that all make sense to you so far? Okay. So it's not, I'm not talking about, let's see, oh, what makes us feel good? We should just go to the amusement park every day and things like that. That wouldn't really do it for us, would it? Hi. So, again, we want purpose in our life. We want to make a difference. We don't want to just look for instant gratification, but in the long run, if we do something that means something to us and then we can have a big success with that, there's nothing that beats that for the higher emotional levels, right? That and communion with our nearest and dearest. Those are, I think, the two biggest things that are causative of happiness. Anybody want to argue with me about that? Yeah, okay. It would be okay if you wanted to. Okay. So, one thing I wanted to especially mention is we can look at what causes us to move up and down the emotional scale. We can also look at what causes other people to move up and down the emotional scale. I read in this book that men don't like to be corrected. They just like to be validated and praised. Well, that's true of all of us, really, but men in particular. So, I looked at this and I said, sure enough, every time I tell my husband, look, you're doing that wrong, you should do this this way. He was not higher on the emotional scale. I validated what he did, and I, you know, I could make a request and say, would you please do this for me? And if he said no, then I let it go. Then it was much, much, much better. I remember my sister was working with a bunch of women, and all they did every lunchtime is sit around and talk about their husbands and how bad they were. On and on and on, all hour, how bad their husbands were. My sister listened to all this, so she says, finally she says, all right, you want to know, because they were complaining their husbands don't help them around the house, and they don't do this, they don't do that. My sister said, okay, you want to know how to get them to do what you want them to do? Oh, yes, they wanted to know this. So she said, okay, every time they do something, you know, in the direction of what you want them to do, you acknowledge the heck out of them.
Give them a
That's right. So if they, you know, make some kind of stab at cleaning the kitchen, even if it's not to your standards, you acknowledge the heck out of them, and then they'll do more of it. I mean, that's true of anybody. It's not just men, for heaven's sake. But these women listened to this, and they said, well, that's not fair. Nobody acknowledges me for washing the dishes. I'm not going to acknowledge him. even though that would get them more of what they want, they weren't going to do it. Absolutely not going to do it. Okay, so you can observe what brings the people around you up and down the emotional scale. When my daughter was little, she's a very, very intense person. Hi. Do we have a chair for you? Okay. My daughter's a very, very intense person, always has been. Her name is Stephanie. She might have called you up at some point along the line. And when she was a tiny child watching cartoons on television, she'd be like this. She's watching the cartoons and she's like, ah. And I realized, this is not fun. This is not entertainment. This is not bringing her up the emotional scale. And so the television went on the shelf and we stopped watching it, except for one night a week when I watched Hill Street Blues. Then one day the television fell off the shelf and broke, and that's the way that went. We didn't have one for several years, and it was a good thing, actually, because it was not doing good things for her at all. Not at all. So it's good to just be able to observe what brings you up and what doesn't bring you up. And it might sound simplistic or silly or frivolous or something, but if you actually study to have more of what you enjoy in your life and less of what you don't enjoy, you're going to be happier. I mean, that sounds silly. It sounds trite or something, but it's actually true. So we'll get to that in a second. Now, what about the kind of person who's way down on the emotional scale, who's so negative that every time you talk to them, you know you're going to get some kind of negative message right between the eyes? It's hard to deal with that, isn't it? It's very irritating. So let's say you get a big promotion at work, and you go home to visit mom, and you say, guess what? You know, of course, all your friends say, wow, fantastic, you got a big promotion, let's go out and celebrate. Everybody's, you know, cheering you on. Go home, and if you have that kind of mother, which luckily I did not, but many people do, you go home to mom and you say, guess what, I got a big promotion. She says, oh, you know, I'm worried that you've taken on too much. You're not going to be able to handle this. Thanks, Mom. It's like, she might as well kick you in the stomach, right? It's very hard to deal with that. I recommend a couple of things. One is just to acknowledge her. And two, to predict that she's going to do it. If she lives down here someplace, she's going to do that stuff. If you read across this table of attitudes, you can see the kind of attitudes people have at the lower reaches of the emotional scale. It's very funny because it's pretty accurate. And it's pretty depressing, actually. So one thing you can do is, if you have a relative particularly who's in that negative frame of mind that they cannot get when you have a good success and they're going to make it mean something bad, what you can do is you can acknowledge them and you can say, oh, well, thank you for your concern. I really appreciate that you care about me and you want me to do well, and I will pay really close attention to that, you know. I'm going to see how this goes with this promotion. Can I handle it or not? And by giving them benefit of the doubt and acknowledging the probably love that's underneath all this garbage that they give you, often that'll kind of make them happy. They'll lay off you. Or if they won't, if they keep on giving you a negative message, you can just say, okay, fine, good, got it, thanks, Mom. And you don't have to get into it with them. Entering into a debate about how, yes, I can handle it, is probably not going to get you anywhere. Has anybody had an experience like that, dealing with somebody who's really negative like that? A few people, yes. Okay. So that's my advice for handling that kind of situation.
Do you just acknowledge that you heard them and you recognize what they said?
Yes.
Sometimes they'll realize that it maybe was just a good thing to say, or sometimes they won't.
Sometimes they won't, but at least you come away from it not feeling brought down.
Yeah.
If you predict, first of all, that they're going to do it, and you acknowledge them, you know, sometimes they brighten up. They actually brighten up, and they might come up the emotional scale themselves. But at least you will not be brought down if you predict that and acknowledge it. Okay. All right, so let's talk about having, the ability to have. It is a major, major ability that human beings have. Okay, having is... could be related to the emotional scale. If you're way down here in grief and apathy, what having looks like is had. Oh, I used to have it, but it's gone now. I had it, but I lost it. That's like grief and apathy, okay? And then it moves up. There's a whole bunch of things we can put in a scale along here that are more or less survival, depending on where it is in relation to the emotional scale. Up at the very top, right around cheerfulness, you start to get somebody feeling responsible for the various things in their life. And at that point, at that level of having, that's actually a very high level of having, because instead of saying, oh, look what happened to me, this is terrible, look what those people did to me, they can say, well, here's the situation, I don't like it, what am I going to do to make it better? So that's a very high level of operation. Have, just plain have, will be in here someplace. Then there's a whole bunch of them, like substitute having is when you can't have what you want, so you have somebody else, something else instead. And then there's wasting the substitute. And there's having and there's wasting having. This is very interesting to look at. I knew a young man who had, he was pretty low on the emotional scale and consequently on the having scale. So he went out and got a big juicy loan and bought a big juicy red sports car. And I said to my sister, you know, I don't think he can really have that. He totaled it the next day. It was true. I predicted this correctly. Okay, so then at the top of the scale, you really get like create. At that point, the person's going out and saying, you know, what do I want in my life? I want this. And they look around and say, nobody's playing that game. Okay, I think I'll start one. And they're actually very, because they're high on the emotional scale and they're, you know, moving pretty fast, they can sort of sweep people up into their orbit and say, come on, everybody, let's play baseball, or let's start a company, or let's do this, or let's do that. And because they're a sort of infectious enthusiasm, people say, okay, yeah, because I want to feel like you do, so I'll play the game you're proposing. So that's a really nice place to be. Now, we can exercise our ability to have things in a different numbers of ways. One way is to just take a walk every day and look at things, just observe things. And I've done this with my clients. I've either taken a walk with them if they were very fragile and overwhelmed at the time and said, notice that tree, notice that car, notice that building, you know, whatever, until they're more calm and stable. Or I've given it to them as homework, take a walk every day and just notice things until you feel better. But you don't have to feel terrible and fragile and overwhelmed to get benefit from doing that. And maybe you don't like to walk, but, you know, you can set up your environment so that it's full of things that you like to observe, and you can deliberately exercise your ability to have them by looking at them. Now, there's different kinds of having. I could look at Kate's beautiful silver bowl there, and I could say, oh, how sad. Kate has that bowl, so I can't have it. Right? Or I could say, wow, is that ever cool? That's really gorgeous. I can enjoy looking at it. And I say, well, I'm glad Kate has that bowl. And I can just leave it there, and I can have it where it is without having to take it home and put it in my house, right? Okay, or you can take a walk in a park. You can see a beautiful fountain or a beautiful statue. And you could say, you know, feel like you can't have it unless you took it home and put it in your lawn. Or you could say, you know, I can have this statue or this fountain right here where it is and let other people have it too. And your having actually goes up. There was a time in my life where I was terribly, terribly poor, and part of that time I wasn't doing so hot. We have this art fair in Ann Arbor every year, and it's getting bigger and bigger. It's huge. People come from all over, and they bring their artworks, and some of them are really fantastic, and some of you go, okay, you call it art, I call it something else, but that's okay. So I used to, for a while, when my having was way low and I was not so high on the emotional scale, I didn't like to go to the art fair because I felt like it was a huge exercise in anti-having. Like, look at all the stuff you can't have, you know? It's pretty depressing. But then later on, I got lots and lots of sessions, and I came up the emotional scale, up the having scale, and then I could, you know, walk around the art fair, or I could walk around downtown, and I look at beautiful things in shop windows, you know, beautiful necklaces and dresses and stuff, say, oh, isn't that lovely? And just enjoy it as it, where it is. Not feel like I have to
pay money for it, take it home, put it in my closet, or put it on my body, or whatever. I can just have it where it is. I can just enjoy it. And I found that worked a whole lot better. So it's nice to put things in your environment that really please you. For me, flowers is a big thing. I grow them, and in the winter I buy them, obviously. And birds, so I feed the wild birds, and they come right to my window, and they're very beautiful. And my cats I'm extremely fond of, so I pamper them, and somebody said, I want to come back next lifetime as one of your cats. They are pretty spoiled. For each person is a different thing, right? So, but you can actually choose to put those things in your environment that really please you, and then you can also remember to actually look at them from time to time, because it's easy to just not be in the present moment and let everything slide by, right? Anybody ever had that experience of, you know, like a whole week went by and you don't even know where it went? Didn't actually notice too much that week. So it's something you can give yourself for homework, just noticing things on purpose, exercising your ability. And that's what this is all about, exercising your ability to be aware of certain things and to expand your ability to have, to be mobile on the emotional scale, particularly upwardly mobile, and things like that, increasing communion. Okay? So I'm talking pretty fast, so I'm doing okay. All right. What I missed here, some little scribbles of red.
Can't wait to go over this one.
All right. Okay, so you can actually study to bring more happiness into your life. And I don't think it's a waste of time. I think it's a really good thing to do. Just think about the people around you. If you're happier, generally speaking, they're happier. And if you're miserable, you tend to pull, there's a certain drag effect, you tend to bring people down, right? So one of the big tricks is being in the present moment in the first place, just being here. That is a big trick. So taking a walk and observing things is one way to get yourself more into the present moment. Doing communication exercises the way we do in our training workshops is another. Doing meditation is another. You know, anything that works for you, I would say. So a lot of people like exercise because they feel like, you know, they kind of brings them into the present. Whatever works for you. Because if we aren't tuned into the present, it doesn't matter what great stuff is going on, we're kind of missing it. Now, there's a motivational speaker called Dr. DeMartini. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of him. He's a chiropractor, started off his whole career as being a chiropractor, and he became a motivational speaker. And he's a really excellent speaker. So I only got to see a videotape of him when I was visiting some friends in Canada. And this guy is pretty brilliant. And his whole shtick, at least on this one video, is gratitude. He talks about being grateful for everything. And that is another huge key to happiness, okay? So I'll give you a couple examples. I know one guy who's had a life-threatening illness his whole life, from when he was a tiny child. So, and it's almost got him a couple of times. He's nearly died a few times. And so he's had to undergo, you know, a lot of drama and strain that he would have probably just as soon skipped. But what he came up with is when he was going through a difficult experience that he really would have rather not gone through, in order to stay in the present moment, he asks himself, what's interesting about this? Isn't that cool? As soon as I heard that, I said, ooh, I'm going to use that one. What's interesting about this? You know, whenever something really that you didn't plan and you didn't want happens, that can be a very useful little tool. Another friend of mine had some kind of disease where her bone in her jaw was kind of like going away. I forget what it was exactly. But they said, okay, we can fix this. We're going to do bone graft here. And I won't go into all the grisly details. But anyway, they cut her open. They're sticking, like, ground up bone in there. I know now more about that than I wanted to know because I had a little piece of that myself. It's really grisly. Anyway, she was thinking, you know, this is pretty horrible. This is very painful. It's not very pleasant. And so she was kind of resisting it to a certain extent. And then she realized, hey, wait a minute. I can be grateful that I live in a time and a place where something can be done about this. I get to keep my teeth. Otherwise, all my teeth would fall out, and that would not be so cool. So gratitude is a really key thing. So I came up with this idea. This is from the new book about happiness that I'm working on. A couple
couple of years you have to give me for that one because I'm involved in thinking on another project at the same time. This is what I decided to call this. I call it Thing and Not Thing. So, if you can, the more of these you can really enjoy and love and appreciate, be grateful for, the happier you will be. So, you want some examples of Thing and Not Thing? I'll give you some examples and then you can see if you can tell me some examples. Alright. If you can enjoy a nice toasty hot day, and you can enjoy a nice chilly, bracing, chilly day, and if you can enjoy new clothing, and if you can enjoy old, comfortable old clothing, the thing and not thing, you see what I mean? If you can enjoy being married or in a committed, stable relationship, and if you are also able to enjoy being single, you've got a big leg up on the whole happiness thing.
And that's a tricky one.
It is a very tricky one, yes. Because most people... Okay. All right. If you can enjoy being in a period of huge activity and frantic running around, and you can also enjoy being in a period of quiet and rest. You see what I mean? If you can enjoy all of that, you're doing way better. Can somebody else come up with some examples of, or an example of thing and not thing?
Well, that's the point. I think it's contrast that makes the world go round. Life holds it together by its spinning, but it's contrast really that makes everything happen.
Yep.
It doesn't sound silly. You can get sleeping or waking.
Yes. Sleeping or waking. That's brilliant. Yeah. If you can enjoy both, you're way better off than you think, oh, I want to be awake all the time, or oh, I want to be asleep all the time. Neither one of those is all that workable, is it?
Being together and being apart.
Good. Yes. Absolutely. How about being hungry and being just comfortably full? Both of those. Yeah.
Actually, when you actually are hungry, and you keep yourself hungry, and you become mindful about your hungriness, then you really enjoy something like it's amazing.
Yeah. Anybody else? How about being poor and being not so poor? Actually, one of the happiest times of my life, I was horrendously poor. And we really had nothing. And a bunch of us would get together on Saturday night, the only time when we're not working, and we would watch whatever stupid thing was on TV. That was before you could get videos of good stuff. We would watch some stupid, mindless thing on TV, and we'd make popcorn, and we'd play cards. And that's all we did, and we would talk. And we had a wonderful time, and we were perfectly happy. It was really, really cool. So I'm glad I had that experience, actually, for some period of time, because I'm not afraid of being poor. I prefer not to be horribly poor, but I don't think I'm going to die the way some people do who never had that experience. If I had to go through it again, I know how to cut a lot of corners and how to make it on very, very little money. So.
You see,
No, that's a good
you
one.
Enjoy beauty and you enjoy everything.
Yeah. You want to say a little more about that?
For example, we all like to enjoy people, some people who look attractive. But sometimes there are people who are very intelligent, they are interesting, but they can't present themselves and they don't look good.
But we can still appreciate them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good. Okay, so you got the idea, right? This is something to, you know, I think this is, once you get this idea, it's something you can play with for the whole rest of your life. It's a challenge to be able to be grateful for everything that comes along. Not that you have to just be like a doormat waiting for everything to hit you and walk over you. It just means we aren't in control of everything, are we? And some things we can control, some things we can't control. So if we can use our abilities to kind of direct life where we want it to go, and meanwhile back at the ranch, you know, something happens, we can take that in our stride. Yeah.
Just a thought. So if you have happiness as one consideration in one mood and one state, is the opposite of happiness sadness? And is that such a bad thing? Because I kind of think that it's not.
Good point. All right, so if we go back to the emotional scale, I lost it, it's back here somewhere. If we go back to the emotional scale, actually the ideal would be is if you could have gratitude for every single one of these emotions. If you could have them and be... have gratitude for every single one of them. You can actually be happy in every one of them if you do it right. That's very, very
see that with these polarities, it's very hard to appreciate one side of the dichotomy unless you've experienced the other.
Yeah.
And therefore, in order, you can't really appreciate these higher emotional tones unless you've also appreciated the lower.
Yeah.
And even vice versa, actually.
Yeah. I think that's a very valid consideration. Yeah, okay?
I was thinking about mindful. When you're mindful, you can appreciate
whatever.
Good things,
mm-hmm.
The bad things. And the same like looking at a problem in the present, that will switch it back, I think, when you got the illusion. That was his thing, that the present is a problem with the present. So if you are thinking, you're mindful about the moment of the situation, like what is interesting about that, and like how this is a challenge for me, and what.
Is it that you actually are grateful for the negative emotions, or is it that you feel peaceful within yourself having the emotions? Because I kind of see it as the latter. I can't imagine necessarily. Maybe I haven't got there yet,
mm-hmm.
but feeling happy to have certain.
Well, all right, I'll give you an example, but I absolutely got what you said.
Yeah.
The example I'm thinking about is when my mother died.
Yeah.
I was grateful to be able to feel that grief, because if I couldn't feel it, there would have been something wrong, you know?
Right.
I mean, I was able to say, yes, we had really a quite wonderful relationship in many ways, and I could just feel that loss, and I could appreciate the togetherness we had that caused the separation to be painful, but it was, you know, she was not young, and it was okay that she went when she went, so I was able to feel all of it and not resist any of it or hold it back or put a lid on it.
I guess, sorry.
Yeah, go right ahead.
If you're feeling immense grief, okay, and the moment you feel gratitude for the grief, you're actually, in a way, not feeling the grief anymore, you're feeling the gratitude, so it's almost like you're stepping out of the grief for a minute as well. That's what I'm... struggling with feeling both at once, with the ability to, because if you're really in the moment of one, can you really feel the other at the same time?
In my experience, yes,
okay.
But, you know, see how it is for you, because it might not be the same. Barry, did you want to say something about that?
Yeah, it seems to me that when you fully appreciate something, you actually transcend it. You know, you lie about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could be, but I actually think you can be in it. You can actually be in it in the moment and experience it and also have a sort of...
If I go over to myself in a session or whatever, if I can get some grief, then I'll try and milk that grief so I can get out of it. Because that's discharging something, right? Yeah. Maybe what we're talking about here is the process of moving to rising above it or transcending it, the more you appreciate it, the more you separate from it, and the less it troubles you, the less you resist it.
Yeah.
I think it's a bit like grieving, where if you allow yourself to grieve fully, really grieve, which is sad,
mm-hmm.
it's sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, not trying to jerk yourself out of it.
I'm happy or sad. It's
yeah.
It's really sad.
Yeah.
I want to cry.
Yeah.
You know, and that, I think just to allow yourself to go through that, I just see it as like this whole color wheel of emotional range. And I do a little bit of problems, sometimes in West America too. But there is this chase for happiness sometimes, but I think it's a little bit disillusioned.
Oh, yeah.
And it's what causes everybody to feel like they've got to be all this perfect society. They take all these Prozac and, you know, perfect Jesus protective world, and war is bad, you know, war is good because they get through the bad guys. And this whole kind of black and white outlook on stuff, which I think is actually dangerous.
Yep.
You know, and so I think the word happiness is, I, you know, with all due respect, I just find it. I guess I keep switching to like an Eastern philosophy too, where you accept the suffering of life, because if you think it's all roses and peaches, you're going to be in a bubble of weirdness.
Yeah, for sure,
you know?
Absolutely.
Well, that's what I mean by mindfulness. That comes from the Eastern philosophy.
Yeah.
So yeah, they say expect the joy, they enjoy the joy when it's there. But they also accept the suffering, because you're always going to have that.
Absolutely.
Look around.
Absolutely. We agree completely. There's no disagreement here.
Yeah,
it's funny, in society, it's almost like someone suddenly goes into tears and you try and stop them.
Yeah, instead of letting them
and
just come through it. Yeah, right.
It feels difficult. I'm sure your mother died when you
cry. Oh, yeah.
That's a good thing. If you don't, that's when you get...
Yeah.
But the same thing with anger, isn't it? It's okay to be angry. How you express your anger and how you allow it to
just by looking at it.
I think that's doing it.
Push something down.
I can't do it.
Yeah, we don't want to push things down. That doesn't get us anywhere.
It doesn't fall sometimes anyway.
It does, absolutely. All right, so just as to wrap it up a little bit, I wanted to talk about the spiritual side of things. How many people are interested in spiritual things? Okay, who's not interested in spiritual things? Anybody? Okay, so cool. The reason I wanted to mention this is, to me, one of the easiest ways to get in a state of bliss is to be really connected to spirit. I got a diagnosis of a life-threatening illness some years ago. It was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, luckily, especially since I ended up not to have the illness. But there for a while, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to die. So, you know, I've been just going along life, okay, one foot after the other, you know, not looking very far ahead, and there's nothing like hearing, you know, the end is coming soon, and maybe go, oh boy, let me look at this whole thing here. And so I spent, you know, a significant amount of time just connecting to spirit, saying, yeah, gotta get tuned in here, because I might need to make the transition here sooner than I planned. And it was actually fantastic, because the practice of doing that, I've never lost it since then. And also, I'm not afraid to die. I wasn't really afraid before, but there was a bigger resistance than I have now. So it's a really nice place to be. And I want to mention this one movie. There's a movie called, there's Jewel of the Nile. There was Romancing the Stone, and then there was Jewel of the Nile, was the sequel. And Romancing the Stone was this light, fluffy adventure movie, and it was fine as far as it went. And then Romancing the Stone, something very odd happened. It was supposed to be a sequel of a nice, light, fluffy, silly adventure romantic movie. And what happened is something profound crept in there, and I don't know whether it was deliberate or what, but the Jewel of the Nile was not actually a jewel. The whole plot hinges on the fact that the bad guys think it's this actual jewel and they want to get their hands on it. But the actual Jewel of the Nile turns out to be this wise man. He's the Jewel of the Nile. And he's really, the guy who played him was like, just had it nailed. He was brilliant. He was in the present moment, responding to the present moment all the way through. So then he was captured. It's like, oh, here I am being captured. You know, so he was being captured. That was okay. And then somebody came to rescue him. Oh, here I am being rescued. I mean, he didn't say that, but you could see he's right in the present moment, observing whatever's happening, participating with whatever's happening. At the end, everybody's happy, and they're all dancing in the square. So he's dancing in the square. Okay, here we are all dancing in the square. Everybody's happy. And I thought it was such a brilliant representation of what a truly mindful, in the present moment, person would be. That's sort of like the ideal of if we could all be there, we'd be in really, really good shape. So, to me, the validation of the whole concept of spirituality and religion is that it leads us in the direction of bliss. Not to say that we don't sometimes go through painful things, right, where our awareness comes up and we realize, oh my gosh, I've been hurting somebody and I didn't even realize it, or I've been thoughtless and I've been causing pain to people and I didn't even realize it. Often that happens, our awareness expands and it's not all that comfortable as we go through facing up to that, but then we end up in a better place, a more able place than we were before. But I really think that if people do religion, whatever their religion is, and it makes them miserable, they're doing it wrong. I really think so. And that whatever religion a person belongs to or subscribes to or adheres to, if it brings them up, generally speaking, brings them up, then it's a validation of what that's all about. That's my personal opinion. We could argue about that if you like. So, one thing I've found to do is, you know how horrible it is when you're waiting for things? Waiting for the elevator, waiting for the traffic light, waiting for this, waiting for that. Isn't it irritating? Doesn't it drive you nuts? Okay, I actually found three prayers from three separate religions that are very, very short that I happen to like. And I'm not going to tell you what they are. You can find your own. But what I do when I'm waiting, I'm stuck waiting. I mean, sometimes I just think, because I love to think. It's fun, right? Think. But if I don't feel like thinking, I just use one of these prayers and I just say it until I get a really nice, calm, centered, you know. And if you're a meditator, you could meditate for however long it takes till the elevator comes or the traffic light turns green. I really think that's a valid practice, and I think it's very useful in promoting happiness. Talking so fast, I finally got done with everything I particularly wanted to say.
Thank you very much.